Largely, if you look at the last 3 years landscape, that is COVID, pre-COVID and post-COVID, and the 2 years after the after COVID, right? So there has been some volatility in the public markets, and that has basically made certain asset valuations very attractive. Any company, if you have a good match in a larger company which has better network effects or a better chance at building a strong moat, economic moat, I think should evaluate M&A as their first choice of exit. We encourage every member in our teams, right? So smallest member of the team, to understand the business really well and understand what problem are we solving for the customer.
Hey, we're back with another episode in Copa Talks, the ultimate CFO podcast brought to you by Blue Copa. Here, we bring you unfiltered access to conversations with veteran finance leaders covering key milestones and challenges in their journey through story. So the last 3 years had a lot of interest into mergers and acquisitions. At one point, getting acquired was the best exit. This gave birth to two schools of thought. One group thinking that this was a self-repair of overvaluations, and the other group thinking it was quick money in short time. In today's episode, we're chatting with Tarun Mallappa, the VP of Finance at Hackerer, on all things mergers and acquisitions, the latest trends, customer obsession in finance, and being a strategic partner to the board. Let's go. Hey Tarun, so glad we're doing this. Welcome to the show.
Hi Guru. Likewise here. Thanks for persistently following up. I'm really glad we're doing this fine.
Absolutely. So just as usual, let's start with your early days, your story, your entry into finance and the journey since then.
All right. So I chose finance not by choice. Actually, it was by default. Mm-hmm. So I'll just give you a backstory to how I ended up in doing my chartered accountancy, right? So, so like I think most of us, I did my graduation with not much planning what I would do after graduation, and all along the journey, I would see many of my classmates pursuing chartered accountancy, and I always told myself this course is so tough. I don't think I'll ever be able to crack this. So I need to figure out a way to build my life after graduation. But I always told myself we'll figure something out. So let's wait for the graduation to get over. And after graduation, I had to take up a job because of some personal side of things, and I worked at a call center for almost 18 months. At the end of 18 months, what happened was a promotion came along my way, and had I taken that promotion, it would mean that I would have to take up more responsibilities, probably have to sign a 2 year secondment, and so on and so forth, right? So I had to take a very big decision in my life for the first time. Yeah. And somewhere I felt that I would be cutting short my professional growth if I took up this promotion. And I decided not to take up the promotion. Instead, I resigned immediately. And to everyone's utter shock, while I was doing well, my resignation came as an utter shock to most of my teammates and my higher-ups at that company. Mm-hmm. I quit, and then I started figuring out what to do next. And I called up my friends and I spoke to them, what are you guys up to? And almost all of my friends were doing CA. So I thought, okay, fine, let me also figure out what this course is all about. And the only other option was doing an MBA, and I had to naturally reach out to my dad to fund my MBA, because MBAs back then were also a 4 to 5 lakh kind of an affair, and 4 to 5 lakhs was a big sum of money. This I'm talking about is 2000 2005-2006.
Okay.
And we had just finished building our house. So my dad was already dipped into a lot of loans and so on. So I didn't want to ask him for any more money. And I thought CA was a very easy easy way to get in because the fees was just about $2,000.
So it was fiscally feasible, but still cracking the CA exam was extremely tough.
I didn't know that it is tough. So all I knew was that, okay, this is a low entry barrier course. And I knew that I will figure something out, but let me get in first and at least to my family's satisfaction, do something, right? Yeah. So I went to the institute, I paid the fees, and they gave me a set of books. So I think institute still does give out the study materials, but back then also they used to give out study materials. And I came home with the study materials in an auto. They were about 25 books. I don't think I had read 25 books in my life so far. Suddenly I was looking at these books and thinking to myself, what have I landed myself into, right? And this was, I think, October, November, and the exams were in May. So there was about 5-6 months of gap, right? Okay. And I took a month off, December, and started my preparations in Jan. And to my disbelief, I ended up clearing the exams in the first shot. This was the entry level stage, which was called the PE2, what we now call, I think now also it's called PE2, or okay. I'm not too sure actually, you might want to check. So this is basically the mid-level qualifiers for the final exam, right? So you have three levels of qualification for a CA exam. You need to go through the foundation route, or you can enter in the middle and then go to the final exam. So I entered in the middle because I had already done my graduation. I didn't have to go to the foundational course, right? So here I am. I cleared the exams in one shot, and my friends who were writing along with me were kind of taken aback. We've been writing this for almost 3-4 attempts. How did you manage to clear this in the first attempt, right? So, so somewhere I feel that I did not know what the exams were all about. And I just went in with first principles thinking, took the study materials that the institute gave and did nothing but those study materials, right? So the problem I think I saw in my friend's approach to preparation was that they did not even open the institute's study materials, right? So they had just been, you know, stacked up in the either in the cellar or somewhere, and they never looked at the study materials, and all they did was probably pick one of these private authors' books and did all sorts of jugglery and all sorts of slicing and dicing and complicated analysis and so on and so forth, and somewhere lost way into the fundamentals of each of the subjects, right? So maybe that worked for me, the fact that I did not know the gravity of the situation, and I just went in with first principles thinking and kind of cracked the exam with not much fanfare, right? Now, after that, the cycle started rolling, and I joined a firm which is outside the Big Four. I would say now I think it is part of the Big Five accounting firm. It's called Grant Thornton. And I was lucky there as well because they had just set up their Bangalore office and they were looking for articles. And back then, emails, while was present, I don't think many people accessed inboxes. So we had to literally, walk into these offices and drop our CVs. So we did that. Back in those days, there were only one or two vacancies, and you would usually see, 30-40 applications, right? So it is very tough to get into a medium to big size firm. And I wanted to do an articleship from a medium to mid size firm. That I was very clear on that, right? So not that small firms are bad. It's just that I wanted to earn a little more than what the small firms were paying. And that was one of the primary reasons why I wanted to join a medium to a small firm. And I knew that the learning would be pretty much same or more in a medium to small, in a medium to big size firm, right? So the hunt started, and somewhere, somehow I ended up on GT's door, and they were just recruiting articles, and my friend and me happened to be one of the first articles to be hired in their Bangalore office. Mm-hmm. And then the journey started. I did my articleship at the end of 4.5 years of stint with GT. I finally, during that time, I kind of dabbled between audit, internal audit, a lot of IPO work. I mean, not a lot. I would say two IPO works in specific. So, our firm was actually appointed as auditors to two listed companies. I mean, companies which got listed while we were the auditors. And I was fortunate enough to work on some of the aspects of these IPOs. Mm-hmm. And that over a period of 4 years, I think I might have spent at least 2 years on listed companies and another 2 years on private companies and other small entities. After almost 4.5 years with GT, post I kind of wanted a change, and I was looking for opportunities, and Hewlett Packard had set up this wonderful team in Bangalore, which was basically like a consulting firm within HP.
Okay.
And they were calling for applications, and a friend of mine had already joined there, and he kind of pulled me in. And that was my first tryst with a corporate structure. And mm-hmm. while I love the magnanimity that comes with large corporates, I somewhere felt that it's too early in a career to kind of become generalized with structures that come with a large corporate.
Okay.
And my learnings would be limited, and hence after I had a very short stint with HP and then moved on to KPMG and worked in the diligence team for almost 2 years. Mm-hmm. Before starting up on my own, started a small firm along with my friends, trying to cater to the medium-sized businesses and small businesses which had aspirations to grow while did not have the affordability to spend on a Big Four consultant. And so we thought that that's a very niche play. And with our experience in multiple Big Fours, we could actually add value. Mm-hmm. And I was part of the firm for almost 5 years before this opportunity at HackerUp came along, where my current boss was actually kind of looking for a full-time VP of finance. And since I'd worked with Sachin in the past and he knew the way I approach things in finance, and since he was comfortable, it was a match made for both. It was basically a match for both of us, and I also wanted to try out this side of things. And while I was a consultant for the longest period of time, there is a realm you can't cross as a consultant, and I think being a finance executive or an operational finance executive, right, gives you that insider's view of things on how business shapes up. And I was very keen to kind of get into such a role, and therefore I joined HackerUp. It's been more than 5 years now. Yeah. And what a ride it has been, having gone through two down cycles and multiple iterations in the business. I don't think I could have asked for anything better.
Got it. I think that's very well summarized. Almost 20 years of experience put together. Great. So you were mentioning that you were in the M&A advisory team at KPMG, right? So we were wondering, you know, it's best we probably seek some wisdom around the M&A space and strategic partnerships, given that you've also taken or worked on the journey of IPO with a couple of startups, you know, during your stints in the earlier companies. So just starting with the M&A bit, across the board, M&A has gotten significant interest in the past 1 to 2 years. What are your thoughts on this?
I think M&A is one of the, I would say it is one of the two best forms of exit for any company. Mm-hmm. Or any founders who are looking for an exit, right? Mm-hmm. I wouldn't. So it's but natural that it has found a liking in the last couple of years, simply mm-hmm. because the markets weren't hot enough. I mean, public markets were kind of volatile, and while we have seen some vibrancy in the very recent past, but mm-hmm. largely, if you look at the last 3 years landscape, that is COVID, pre-COVID and post-COVID, and the 2 years after the after COVID, right? So there has been some volatility in the public markets, and yeah. that has basically made certain asset valuations very attractive. When I say asset valuations, I mean to say some private companies are basically at a better valuation, I would say. I'm not talking about the 21-22 era when there is a lot of froth in the market, right? So encouraged by a lot of free money or easy money that was getting floated around. So if you can leave that phase aside, 2023 and the 2024 so far has been times of, I would say, best times to do an M&A, simply because post 2022 tech meltdown, which basically yeah. was followed by, which was basically triggered by increasing interest rates in the US, which basically cut short a lot of growth plans for the company because they weren't able to raise funds and so on. The froth kind of went away, and the valuations kind of corrected themselves, and M&A markets are basically ripe when asset valuations are kind of go through a correction, right? Yeah. While in general, M&As are omnipresent. I would say M&As are omnipresent, but it's just that they hit a peak when the assets correct themselves, right? So 2023-24 are such years. Whole of 2023, the second half or the later half of 2022, and the whole of 2024, I hope, are mm-hmm. basically years when you will see a lot of M&A activities, especially yeah. around tech, because as I said, the valuation multiples have dropped significantly enough, and while they have corrected marginally in the last 4-5 months, you can still call that there is a significant correction in the valuation, number one. Number two, I think reason number two why M&As are preferred today is simply because let's look at the tech companies, right? So you will see that most of them are venture backed, or mm-hmm. there is some sort of financial investor who is on the cap table, and everyone's looking for an exit, right? So, and public markets are in India is not mature enough to palate the complexity or the nuance that comes with a tech company, right? Because you have so many things playing for a tech for a tech company in the form of, let's say, there are certain modes which takes time to build. The network effects kind of kick in at very late stages of a company, and customers are very demanding in terms of in terms of what they want. So one needs to keep pouring money into product development, customer centricity, and so on and so forth. So there is severe pressure on the margin. All right. Sometimes, sometimes profits not present at all for extended periods of time. While profits are present, there is severe pressure on margins, on net margins I'm talking about. While gross margins could be healthy, net margins do go through some stress because of, you know, your customer acquisition cost, customer retention cost, pricing pressures, and so on and so forth, right? So, so therefore, public markets, unless mature, will not welcome a non-performing company or underperforming company. And for that reason, one needs to kind of wait it out for hitting the public markets. Mm-hmm. While many investors do wait, some of the investors have a certain cycle that they need to adhere to, and they are in a hurry to kind of return the money to their investors, and therefore M&A seems to be the most viable option. The other side of the story is that for an acquirer, M&A kind of bolsters their entire IPO game, right? So it's like this. Imagine this is like a journey, right? It's like a journey of where the goal is to basically reach the destination with a full bus. Now, all along the journey, you kind of add passengers to the bus, and eventually when the bus reaches the destination, it's full, right? So for an acquirer, it's basically the inorganic growth, which is basically what the lever that works for them, is a great way to bolster their top line and to some extent their bottom line as well, and also add product capabilities and moat, right? So it works well for the acquirer as well. So while the companies which are getting acquired have other interests, the acquirer interests are always, almost always financial, and it is kind of aimed at going public eventually, right? So so I think these are the reasons why I feel that M&A is kind of hot again and is being evaluated more and more for exits at, in software domain at least.
I really love your statement that M&A is one of the two best options for exits today, right? I'm just going to go further and ask you, do you think it is the best option today, or would you say it's still one of the good options, given that there's a lot of funding, struggle that's happening around?
I would say any company, if you have a good match in a larger company which has better network effects or a better chance at building a strong moat, economic moat, I think should evaluate M&A as their first choice of exit than trying to go public, simply because going public, the bar is very high, right? Yeah. So in terms of certain financial conditions that you need to meet, that is basically the minimum amount of revenue that you need to have, and so on and so forth, right? Because there is a certain size at which you can go public. If you're a company where you're growing fast, you are building a good economic moat, and you can defend that moat for a sustainable periods of time, then I would say make IPO as your only exit option, right? You don't need an M&A. But If you have doubts on any of these, that is, your growth is slowing, your economic moat is either present or you don't know, and you don't know whether you'll be able to defend your competitive advantage for a sustainable period of time, right? So if any of these things are present, I think you should definitely evaluate M&A, because what it does is, by joining forces with others, you're only going to become that much stronger, right? So in unity is strength. So I would say, if you have a homogeneous company, larger, smaller, or same size, it doesn't matter. It is homogeneous in the in the context that you're pretty much in a similar business or in the same value chain, in the customer context, right? And there is certain basic conditions that are being met. There is founder match, and so on and so forth. I think those are things, and every M&A will have to go through. To cut the story short, if you are operating in a value chain which is common from a customer point of view, I would say choose M&A over IPO, because the bar is very high for an IPO. I mean, you have in Indian market, for example, an SME IPO and the main board IPO. In the US, you have the big listings in the US. I think US is a very tough market to list, simply because the benchmarks have gone really high. If you take the most recent case, I think Rubrik is doing almost 800 million in ARR. And they listed at a valuation which is, I think, 7 or 8 times to their ARR multiples, right? And they're still loss-making. Now, I don't think the Indian public markets would understand the nuance of a business like Rubrik. And while India is a... Indian markets may value profitable businesses higher than the US markets, but the Indian public markets' understanding of the nuances which goes into a technology business is yet to develop. So I would say, if you're a tech business, you should wait it out. At least 2 to 3 years. Before IPOing in India, the best way would be to combine forces with another company or many more companies, bolster your P&L and balance sheet by adding more revenues, by building better teams, and basically adding that competitive advantage from product and a revenue point of view, and then go public.
Got it. I think that's well summarized. So you were mentioning that there were a lot of parameters when two companies come together and evaluate an M&A scenario, right? As a finance leader, right, from your lens, what kind of parameters do you go through before evaluating if it's a good deal for you as an acquirer and an acquiree?
All right. Let me talk about it from an acquirer point of view. What we do is typically what we do at HackerEarth is that we look at companies from three angles. Number one being whether the technology and the product itself marries well with our vision, right? And the second criteria is obviously the financial performance and the size of the company and so on. Yeah. The third is valuation. So when all these three factors kind of align well, is when I think the acquisition is set to go forward. Otherwise, I think so far, I think. What I have seen is that most of the acquisitions are not very homogeneous in the in the sense that they're not very well aligned with the business that we are in. And somewhere I feel there is a disconnect in marrying some of these companies to what we do.
So you mentioned that there were specific reasons why this match could not happen, or there is some disconnect, right? So what would those be?
So primarily the businesses need to generate some amount of synergies post acquisition, right? So what I mean to say is that when it has to be, it cannot be 2 plus 2 is equal to 4. 2 yeah. plus 2 has to be more than 4, right? Only then I think one should go ahead with an acquisition. And unless you see that equation playing out, I don't think an acquisition will really make sense, because what you are seeing is 2 plus 2, but the cost of integration, the cost of the transaction itself, the cost of cultures coming together and so on and so forth, there is a lot of net value lost in an acquisition, right? So the 2 plus 2 will always become, you know, less than 4, and hence most acquisitions fail. So unless you are able to prima facie see that these two companies coming together will add tremendous value when they come together, I don't think one should go ahead with that acquisition.
Got it.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. Perfect. And in terms of M&A, since it's been picking up for the past 18 months, what are some trends that you're able to see today?
Okay. The trends that I'm seeing is... See, software M&As are kind of few and far, simply because because all companies are kind of in the process of getting fit, and they are not fit yet. So you are seeing that only those companies which have grown modestly well and have meaningful profits, or it's the other way around, who have grown meaningfully well and have some modest bottom line improvements are kind of getting some inbound interests, while heavily growth focused companies with little or with little competitive advantage are not finding the market very attractive from an M&A point of view. So I think this trend will get better as we go into 2024. Already the software median multiple, I think, has climbed up from somewhere in the 3.5 to 4 range to, I think today it is hovering around the 5.5 to 5.7 range. This I'm talking about is ARR to EV multiples. I think that's a good indicator of which way the market is headed. So to give you a context, right, at the peak of the bubble, we had seen that median multiples would go up to 16, 17, and, you know, there are companies which even got above 40, 50 multiples on their ARR, right? So I'm talking about, from that point of view, the median multiples, even if they stabilize around 6 or 7, right, I think we can conclude that they have normalized, the markets have normalized. Now everybody is valuing the business and not having some sort of a FOMO or, you know, or some other, you know, excitement through, because of which you are kind of investing or because of which you are buying and so on and so forth, right? So so that's the trend I'm seeing. And non-tech, I don't really follow non-tech as much, but some of the, I think in India at least, businesses which are playing for the consumption theme in India and have achieved fairly good product market fit, I think are ready for acquisition. I think there are dime a dozen legacy brands which are waiting to kind of lap up these smaller brands which have on their own innovated, created a new category and built a meaningful business around that concept, while these businesses might not be sizable in nature, but the fact that these businesses or their products have found a liking in customers will basically send out the right messages to the legacy companies, and they would be definitely ripe for acquisition. Apart from consumption tech, I think industrials and other segments will also kind of go through a similar phase. I think there was never, I would say, a froth in those segments. So they've always stayed normal, and any good companies are up for grabs. If you see the recent acquisition of Sutures India by, I think that was KKR, right? So so there is enough and more capital available for good and profitable companies at every scale, be it a 1 or 2 year old a D2C startup or a 5 to 6 year old software startup or a 15 to 20 year old legacy business. So there is enough capital available for pretty much all businesses, and so long as you are built in a very efficient manner, I think acquisition is here to come.
Got it. Makes sense. Great. So ever since we started working with you folks, we've been interacting very much. And one thing I've noticed from all the folks at Blue Copa who work with you personally and your team have mentioned is that you have an insane customer obsession. So I'm just going to double down on that and understand a couple of things from you, especially given that customer obsession and finance are slightly, a little far away from each other. Though it's supposed to be together, it's a little far away. So starting with, why should the finance team even have customer obsession, and what kind of outcomes do you get with that?
All right. So to us, we have two sets of customers. I think this has been our narrative within our teams. Mm-hmm. One is internal and the other one being external, right? So we value both internal and external customers alike. While we give more weightage to the external customers, but internal customers are valued very highly. Let's talk about the external customers first. So to a finance team, the external stakeholders or customers are your revenue generating customers, your vendors, and your shareholders, right? So let's talk about the revenue earning customers. Now, as finance teams, you are kind of sitting on some data points and some insights which probably nobody else in the organization has, right? So it's very important that this insight kind of gets relayed back to the teams so that they take the necessary action and kind of work on it and deliver advantage to the corporate, to the company. Got now, without having a customer obsession, without understanding what you do in your core as a company, right? So what is that core problem that we're trying to solve? Without understanding that, mm-hmm. I don't think any finance team will be able to add value to the organization's growth.
True that.
I think this is a fundamental belief that that we have. So what I do is we encourage every member in our teams, right? So smallest member of the team to understand the business really well and understand mm-hmm. what problem are we solving for the customer. And that will not come if you don't have customer obsession. therefore, having a deep understanding of the problem that we are solving is basically a proxy for customer obsession, which kind of helps us in doing work beyond the routine and add value to the growth prospects of the company. So to just put it in simple terms, right? I think as accounting and finance teams, I think most companies have today moved away from doing the usual accounting slash reporting stuff, and kind of basically extended the boundaries beyond the realm of finance and accounting, and have started looking at kind of juxtaposing a lot of other departments' data and looking at the holistic picture, right? Now, to be able to kind of infer from all the data that you put together and infer right, you need to have customer obsession and a business understanding. I think gone are the days when accounts and finance teams can be devoid of getting into the business side of things and just be bookkeepers and gatekeepers of finance and gatekeepers of cash and so on and so forth. Right? So those days are gone. I think that is a very common narrative that I'm seeing across all finance heads today. That, and everyone acknowledges that unless we have a deep understanding, we as in the finance team has a deep understanding of the business, we can't add value in terms of plugging revenue leakages, taking advantage of price increases, stopping unnecessary or improper revenue expenditures, bad allocation of capital towards capex, and so on and so forth. Right. So,
got it.
I'll give you a simple example. When we were actually choosing an office for ourselves, we were looking for a new rented office. This was basically post-COVID, and we were coming out of the remote working phase, and we were looking for an office. And we were around 180 to 200 people strong company back then. Okay. And the finance team was obviously tasked with the option to come up with a few office locations. And one of the things that we really wanted to understand from the business is that how much are we going to grow and what's going to be our employee strength over the next 2 to 3 years. And because based on that, we need to select the right type of an office.
Yeah.
And we got the right inputs from the business, and we were able to zero down on the size an office which is basically meeting all our requirements, and at the same time is not stressful on our P&L, right? So so this constant interaction with internal and external customers, I think, has to come naturally to the finance teams, and
got it.
And that's where we will continue to add value.
Got it. And how do you go about building such a culture within the organization? Now, Tarun could be customer obsessed. How does he build it across the board, at least within the finance team?
Rigor. I think there is nothing else. So you need to drive it. I don't think it comes naturally to everyone, but one needs to have the rigor to talk about it every day, if not every day, at least once in 2 days, and you know, drive that obsession into everyone. There is no other. There's no shortcut to it. I mean, it doesn't come naturally to everyone. Let's accept that, and build the a system around it. So what we do, what I do is. Practice rigor and keep driving this narrative home that we need to care for our customers. We need to know what they want. only then our work will be meaningful and add value to the company.
Got it. Great. So coming to the last section of the session, right? It's impossible for us to do the whole conversation without talking about AI, given that it's one of the most important buzzwords, even in finance today. So I want to pick your brain on how do you think AI is going to impact the M&A space, if there are any processes or any things that AI could replace today? Would love to know that.
Oh, sure. So I see that a lot of the work that we do around diligence today can mm-hmm. be automated to a great extent with AI.
Right.
So the M&A discussions are going to be very objective, and one could actually complete a transaction sooner than later because right. of AI, right? Not just time, you'll also get more qualitative insights, and the teams that need to work on transactions will reduce. The process will become a lot more streamlined, and I see that it's going to really help the M&A process significantly at the diligence stage. Right now, let's go one step back. On the sourcing side, I'm pretty sure there are already companies which are working on identifying targets for acquisitions and so on using AI, because yeah. there's a lot of data available today and you can kind of pay and get the data on company, their performances and so on and so forth. So there is some solutions already available in the market for sourcing deals. Mm-hmm. I think that will only get better from here on. Diligence, as I said, will get a lot more streamlined and a lot more insightful analysis and so on. Other than that, I don't see much of an impact from AI on M&A as such. Maybe here and there would be some small improvements, let's say pitch deck preparations and so on, but I would say I think it's best left to humans to prepare yeah. pitch decks. But yeah.
Got it. Perfect. Great. So those were the questions I had for today. Thank you so much, Tarun, for taking the time and, you know, sharing your wisdom around and customer obsession. Thank you.
Thanks, Guru. It was lovely talking to you.
Thank you.